welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. I hope you had a wonderful Valentine's Day and are still enjoying your flowers, nibbling at your chocolates, and basking in a romantic glow. Last week, we were all about the love stories. This week, we'll focus on life stories. No, not biographies, but novels about the twists and turns that life inevitably takes. I've collected an entertaining new selection of titles, so let's begin as we turn to page one of the book report. If you loved fried green tomatoes, you're going to love Fanny Flagg's new book, The All-Girl Filling Station's Last Reunion. Mrs. Sookie Poole of Point Clear, Alabama, has just married off the last of her daughters. She's hoping to relax and enjoy life now with husband Earl. The only thing left to contend with is her mother, the formidable Lenore Simmons Crackenberry, a lady loved in the town for her quirky individuality, but who is, in fact, an overbearing handful. One day, Sookie receives a phone call about a secret from her mother's past, and in a flash, everything Sookie thought she knew about herself is in question. Sookie begins a search for answers that takes her to California, the Midwest, and back in time to the 1940s. There we meet Fritzy, who, during World War II, had to run her family's filling station when her brother was called to war. But Fritzy is also destined to fly high, and following her, we get a look at the fly girls of the war, the Wasps. Readers, this one starts off a bit slow, but it becomes great fun with some wonderful little-known history in the mix. The author narrates.
Tuesday, June the 7th, 2005. The next morning, Sookie woke up early, prepared to try and solve her bird problem. Earl had just walked out the door when the phone in the kitchen started ringing, and she wondered who in the world was calling her so early. It couldn't be Lenore. She was on her way to water therapy at the senior center. Oh, dear God, please don't let it be Dee Dee saying she was moving back home. She knew she was having marital problems again, and today's horoscope had warned her to expect the unexpected. Sookie looked at the phone with trepidation and read the number on the readout. It wasn't Dee Dee. It was that same area code as yesterday, probably the same phone solicitor, so she didn't pick up. She didn't have time to talk to anybody now. She had to concentrate on her bird feeding plan. It was going to be tricky. She'd seen how those blue jays could go through all their food in just a matter of minutes, so she was going to have to move very fast. Sookie quickly rinsed off her breakfast dishes and stuck them in the dishwasher, but whoever was calling wouldn't hang up, and it was distracting. They used to have an answering machine, but Lenore thought it was an open mic for her to speak into on any subject at any time and had left 15 and 20-minute messages on it, sometimes in the middle of the night, so they had to get rid of it. After she finished up in the kitchen, she debated whether to put the sunflower seeds for the blue jays in the front yard or the back. If she put the sunflower seeds in the front, someone driving by might see her and want to stop and talk, and she didn't have a second to spare. So she decided she would start at the back and run to the front. Her success depended on how long it would take the blue jays to finish the sunflower seeds before they discovered the bird seed in the front and how fast she could run from one yard to the other. But what shoes should she wear? She looked down and realized that she shouldn't try to run in her flip-flops. It was too dangerous. She went to her closet and found nothing suitable. Practically every shoe she owned had a little heel. She went down the hall to the twins' bedroom closet and started rummaging through a box of their old shoes. She found a pair of worn-out pink sneakers with pom-poms. Unfortunately, they were two sizes too large, but they'd be better than trying to run in flip-flops and breaking an ankle. She put them on and laced them up as tightly as she could and went out to her greenhouse and filled her two large ceramic polka-dotted birdseed containers, one with sunflower seeds and the other with the wild birdseed. She went out and placed the container with the wild birdseed on the side of the house, ready to be picked up as she ran by, headed to the front yard. She then went back to the greenhouse, picked up the container with the sunflower seeds, took a deep breath, and ran to the backyard, filling up the feeders as fast as she could. After Sookie finished filling the feeders in the backyard, she dropped the container on the ground and ran to the side of the house and picked up the other polka-dotted seed container and was running toward the front yard when she stepped in a gopher hole and lost her left shoe. She couldn't stop, so she just went on without it. And of course, the very same moment she hit the front yard, the new Methodist minister and his wife were driving by the house and saw Sookie, wearing one pink shoe with tassels, hopping on one foot, throwing seeds from a large polka-dotted container at her feeders. They slowed down, and as a matter of courtesy, were going to stop and say hello, but thankfully for Sookie, decided against it and quickly drove on. They were from Scotland and didn't know if running around wearing one pink shoe with tassels while carrying a large polka-dotted container and throwing seeds was some kind of southern bird-feeding ritual or not, but they were afraid to ask.
We've just heard the all-girl Filling Station's Last Reunion by Fanny Flagg. Another book about female flyers, this one from a series by Jennifer Niven that The Book Report has just discovered. Becoming Clementine begins in England, 1944. An American woman volunteers to co-pilot a plane carrying special agents to their drop spot over Normandy. Her personal mission, to find her brother who is MIA. When her plane is shot down, she must scramble to stay alive. As she heads to Paris, aviatrix Velveteen Hart becomes Clementine Roux, a daring woman on a mission with her team to capture an operative known only as Swan. Once settled in Paris, Clementine works as a spy with the resistance. She finds herself falling in love with her fellow agent Emile, a mysterious Frenchman with secrets of his own. When Clementine ends up in the most brutal prison in Paris, she discovers the depth of human cruelty and the triumph of her own spirit. Kathy Mazur narrates.
They said the B-17 had mythical powers, that it was magic because it could defend itself, even with the pilot knocked cold and no one at the wheel, and that it could return home even if it was blown apart. It was the fiercest fighter of the war. The Flying Fortress, a daylight precision bomber that flew smooth for being so big and heavy, as smooth as Three Gum River back home in North Carolina on a sunny, cloudless day. But now I had to hold on tight to the wheel and the throttle to keep the plane from dropping or turning or rattling away from me. I was going to be the second woman in history to pilot a bomber across the Atlantic Ocean. I was dressed in my Santiago blues, the official uniform of the WASP, or Women Air Force Service Pilots, with a smart little hat and a fitted navy skirt designed by Bergdorf Goodman in New York, and I had a .45 pistol strapped to my hip. I was flying a crew of 11, and three of those were girls— Helen Stilbert, who was also a WASP, and my friend Beryl Goss, or Gossie, who was serving in the Women's Army Corps, and me. Helen sat in the co-pilot's seat. She was going to fly the B-17 back across the ocean on our return. Suddenly the bomber shuddered, and for one second I wondered if we'd been hit. It rocked and rolled side to side, and just then, I didn't care about being the second woman in history. The only thing I cared about was getting to Scotland in one piece, because I was on a secret mission. I was on my way to Europe to find my brother, Johnny Clay. I climbed up and up, pushing the B-17 heavenward through the winds and the fog, because the thermals were usually calmer the higher you flew. Thermals were giant trees of air that rose above the earth, caused by the change in temperature. I climbed higher, right up into the thunderclouds. I was flying almost blind, so I dropped a bit, trying to get below the winds. In my headset, I could hear Helen saying, "Can't we get above these clouds, Heartsy?" She sounded cross and scared. Johnny Clay had gone missing, and the only person who knew I was planning to find him was me. I didn't have a clue in the world where he was, but the last letter I had from him was dated October 18, 1943, from a base in England. Johnny Clay was a paratrooper with the 101st Airborne. His unit had made the jump on the Normandy coast on June 6th, a little over a week ago, but Johnny Clay hadn't jumped with them, and no one could tell me why or where he was. Over 300,000 troops had landed or gone ashore along a 50-mile stretch of beach to fight the Germans. I knew Johnny Clay better than anyone, and if there was one thing I knew for certain, nothing on earth, not a gold mine stuffed fat with gold, or our own dear mama herself come down from heaven, would have kept him from jumping out of that plane on D-Day. Suddenly, the B-17 dropped 2,500 feet, knocking the breath right out of me. It was the heart in the throat, stomach in the knees feeling of free-falling, the same feeling I'd had practicing parachute landings from a platform at Avenger Field in Sweetwater, Texas, where I learned to be a wasp. I could see the dark blue-black of the ocean below me, and the clouds overhead, and on all sides, closing in tighter and tighter on the B-17, as if they were trying to smother the life right out of us. The last place I wanted to die was in a bomber flying over a freezing cold ocean, my family far away and missing me, my brother captured or dead, without me even knowing what had happened to him. And what if he needed me? What if just that minute he was calling my name, hoping I'd come rescue him? The plane dropped again, 1,200 feet this time. In my headset, I could hear the flight engineer and tail gunner swearing. I could hear the bombardier being sick on his stomach over and over again, and the navigator yelling something at me, but it sounded like he was underwater. Then, from the back of the plane, I could hear Gossie, her voice as dramatic and loud as Katharine Hepburn's. "It's cold as a witch's left teat, Mary Lou. Don't you dare crash this plane."
We've just heard Becoming Clementine by Jennifer Niven. Anita Shreve hails from Massachusetts, and many of her books have a New England setting. After graduating from Tufts University, she taught high school for a number of years in and around Boston. Then, recognizing she must follow her passion, she left teaching and began to write. Joking she could wallpaper her bathroom with rejections from magazines for her short stories, she finally began to be published in literary journals. One of these stories, Past the Island Drifting, won an O. Henry Prize. Switching to journalism, Anita traveled to Nairobi, Kenya, where she lived for 3 years working as a journalist for an African magazine. Her novel, The Last Time They Met, was inspired by her African experiences. Returning to the U.S., Shreve worked as a writer and editor for a number of magazines in New York. In 1989, she published her first novel, Eden Close. In 1999, she received a phone call from Oprah Winfrey, and The Pilot's Wife became the 25th selection of Oprah's Book Club and an international bestseller. In April 2002, CBS aired the film version of The Pilot's Wife, and in fall 2002, The Weight of Water, starring Sean Penn, hit the big screen. Anita has written 17 incredibly popular books. Today we'll speak with her about her newest title, Stella Bain. Welcome, Anita, and thanks so much for joining us on The Book Report.
I'm glad to be here.
Stella Bain has such a fascinating and completely unexpected storyline. How did it come to you?
Well, it originally started that I had a character from a previous novel who hadn't gotten to tell her side of the story. And so, in a sense, I was locked into the time period, which happened to be the years of World War I. And so I took her and put her on the battlefield in World War One as a nurse and also as an ambulance driver. And during the book, she experiences shell shock. And her journey, when she wakes up, she doesn't even know who she is. It's the first half of the book is her attempt to find out who she is.
Right. You know, shell shock, it was so interesting for me to read it. Of course, today we would call it post-traumatic stress, which is so much in the news as our veterans return from Afghanistan. Yeah. Did this influence you while you were writing?
Well, I really focused on the time period and what was fascinating to me about then, which equates to what's happening now also, is in the first part of the war, 1914 to 1916, they didn't even recognize shell shock as an ailment, and the men who exhibited those signs were considered to be malingerers, and they more often than not were sent right back to the front lines, which, as we all know, is the worst place to send somebody in that condition. In all the research I did, and I went right back to the sources, you know, papers written in 1919 where they were gathering up numbers of injured, et cetera, there was not a single case of a woman diagnosed with shell shock. And we know that they came under combat, they were shelled, some were killed, and in the field tents, they had to deal with the worst that the war had to offer.
Right. Your writing is so evocative of that time and place. How long did you actually spend researching that?
Well, I spent... You research. It's not like a scholar. A scholar goes out and researches and then has an idea and writes a book with that idea in mind. A fiction writer really wants to tell the story. The story is everything. But then you come to a point very early on, and in this case, really early on in the book, when it's obvious I need to know a lot about shell shock before I can even write the first word.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really had done most of my research before I even started writing the book.
Your supporting characters are so fascinating, and I believe you to be pretty fearless in the themes that you explore. For example, tell us a bit about Philip Asher.
Yes, Philip Asher is someone whose reputation was ruined. He's an academic whose reputation was ruined in America, and he becomes a Red Cross ambulance driver in World War One, and in her previous life, Stella Bain knew Philip Asher, and she needs to apologize to him because it was her family that ruined him. And we do eventually find him, and he has dealt with the war in a way that you might not expect. He's quite chipper. He's stoic. He tries to find the beauty in life. I loved him as a character.
I did, too. We're speaking with Anita Shreve on The Book Report. You know, I've always wondered, just stepping away from Stella Bain for a moment, what was it like for you to receive the call from Oprah Winfrey to be told your book would become a book club selection?
It was a shock. I mean, I hadn't... This is the last thing on my mind the night when her, the fellow who worked with her and got in touch with the authors, you know, and when he called, you know, and I said, "What's this about?" And he said, "Oh, we're just a small literary group in Chicago." And that did not ring any bells. And then the next thing I knew, there was this booming voice on a speakerphone saying, "Anita, I loved your book." And I said, "Thank you." And the voice said, "It's Oprah." And that was just an unbelievable shock.
Yeah. Something very unique. You've written a chapter in a new book called Knitting Yarns, Writers on Knitting.
I have.
Yeah, and you're in very good company. Sue Grafton, Andre Dubas, John Dufresne, Barbara Kingsolver. Tell us about this project.
Well, Ann Hood, I believe, was the mastermind behind this. And she just, you know, she in her travels, she got to know, she knits all the time, and she got to know a lot of knitters. And I'm one, and we talked about it. And I, you know, if you can't actually be knitting, reading about knitting is great fun. So, You know, I have another author friend, Eleanor Lippman, and we're passionate knitters, and it's just something that takes over, and I think it really takes the place of meditation.
Huh. You know, a personal anecdote, I recently went to Iceland, and on the plane there was a group of about 50 women who were on a knitting tour of Iceland and Scotland. I never knew this existed. Anita, I've so enjoyed our conversation. Any final thoughts?
No, I've enjoyed it too. And, you know, my hope is that readers will find their way to the independent bookstores and the bookstores and the and Amazon and read the book.
You know, I thought it was really fascinating and so multi-layered. I want to congratulate you. I read it in one sitting. It was that good.
Wow. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Anita, for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Now let's hear a sampling of Stella Bain, performed by Hope Davis.
You have been unconscious for 2 days, the sister explains, stepping back and fussing with the sheets as she slides Stella's feet from under the covers. Your feet had bits of shrapnel in them when you arrived. Someone with a cart left you outside the tent in the middle of the night. I should like to examine your feet. This is someone else's story, Stella thinks, not hers. What is your name? Stella. She pauses. Where am I? Marne. Marne is in France? Yes, the sister answers, pursing her mouth. My name is Sister Luke. I am British, but almost everyone else at the camp is French. We believe your boots blew off when you were knocked unconscious by the first shell, and that a second shell injured your feet. You had not a scratch on you otherwise, apart from some bruises from falling. Will I be able to walk? Stella asks. Sister Luke studies her. I think you are American.
Am I?
From your accent. But you were found in a British VAD uniform. Stella cannot explain this. You are a VAD?
I don't know.
Stella can see that the sister is annoyed and has other more pressing matters to attend to. But I know how to drive an ambulance, she blurts out.
Is this true?
If not, why does she think it is? You know this, and yet you do not know your posting? The sister asks with barely concealed disbelief.
Yes, the paradox is bewildering, but does not seem urgent. Beyond the canvas, Stella knows everything is urgent.
The sister moves toward the opening in the compartment. Apart from your feet, I can find nothing wrong with you. You will have them examined and dressed on a regular basis. Then you will rest and eat and drink while we ascertain your identification. We will contact all the nearby hospital camps. You cannot have come very far. When your feet are better, you can work. Perhaps we will see if you can drive that ambulance after all. In the meantime, you are to remain here. What is your last name?
Stella simply shakes her head.
Orders are given, and a nurse's aide arrives with a tray. The dressing of Stella's wounds is more painful than she would have thought possible. The aide, who looks exhausted, helps Stella drink 2 glasses of water. Stella feels sorry for the young woman and does not ask questions, because she knows the effort it will take to answer them. Stella's last name comes to her the way a bird takes flight. She tells the aide, I am Stella Bain. When the aide leaves, Stella closes her eyes and then opens them. She repeats this exercise several times, but no matter how often she does it, she cannot remember what regiment she was attached to or what she was doing on a battlefield. 1 month later, Stella has recovered from her wounds and serves as a nurse's aide in a French uniform. Again, she puzzles over the way her skills have returned to her, even though she does not know where she learned them. Stella is appalled by her surroundings. The soil thick with manure, mud-laced wounds causing suppurating infections, compound fractures imposing a death sentence. A swab of Lysol along with gauze dipped in iodine is all the medicine on offer. A gas gangrenous wound, not to be confused with the effect of poisoned gas, balloons up to grotesque proportions. Stella watches a doctor play an idle beat upon a man's flesh with his fingers. The sight is awful, the sound hollow. Almost all the men die. Sometimes the doctor's screams are louder than the patient's. The surgeon's job is beyond belief. A hell on earth worse than any hell imagined.
That was Stella Bain by Anita Shreve. Someone by National Book Award winner Alice McDermott portrays an ordinary life with its sharp pains and unexpected joys. It unfolds with scattered recollections of childhood, adolescence, motherhood, old age, as they come together in this spellbinding narrative. We first glimpse Marie as a child, waiting on a Brooklyn stoop for her dad to come home from work. We continue to Marie's first heartbreak, her eventual marriage, her brother's brief stint as a Catholic priest, then the Second World War, the lives of Marie's children, and the changing world of her Irish-American enclave in Brooklyn. Kate Redding performs the work.
I batted at the dirt until Pegeen threw back her head in elaborate frustration, pulling the coat forward, winding it around her like a cloak. "I'll be happy," she said, slapping at her hip, "to stop going to that filthy place," meaning Lower Manhattan, where she worked. She paused, put her nose to the air in mock confidence. "I'll get a boyfriend," she said. She batted her eyelashes and drew out a sly smile. They were great kidders, the Khehabs, and no boyfriends, it seemed, had yet called for Pegeen. "I'll get myself married," she said, and then licked all at once the four tall fingers of the gloveless hand and swatted them against the dirty cloth. "Ramadan," she said again, which, she explained, was her mother's word for fool. And then she released the skirt of her long coat and, dipping her shoulders, shook herself back into it again. She reminded me of a bird taking a sand bath. "I fell down," she announced. She said it in the same fond and impatient tone she had used to describe the lost glove, the forgotten library book, on the subway. It was the tone a mother might use, speaking about a favorite unruly child. Pegeen blew some exasperated air through her pouched-out lower lip. "I don't know what the blazes makes me fall," she said impatiently. "I do it all the time." She suddenly squinted, and the flush just under her downy skin rose to a deep maroon. She lowered her face to mine. "Don't you dare tell my mother," she said. I was 7 years old. I spoke mostly to my parents, to my brother, to my teachers when I had to. I gave some whispered response to Father Quinn or to Mr. Lee at the candy store when my mother poked me in the ribs. I could not imagine having a conversation with Mrs. Khehab, who was red-haired and very tall. Still, I promised. I would say nothing. Pegeen shook herself again, standing back and lifting her shoulders inside the pale blue coat. "But there's always someone nice," she said, her voice suddenly gone sing-song. "Someone always helps me up." She struck another pose, coy and haughty, as before, her chin in the air. She touched the feather in her hat. "Today a very handsome man gave me his hand. He asked if I was all right. A real Prince Charming." She smiled again and looked around. Just a few doors down, the older boys were playing stickball in the street. There was a knot of younger ones on the curb watching. Bill Corrigan was in his chair on the sidewalk just behind them. Pegeen leaned forward once more. "Tomorrow," she said breathlessly, whispering now. I'm going to look for him again. If I see him, I'm going to get real close. She leaned down, her hand on the banister above my head. I'm going to pretend to fall, see? Right next to him, and he'll catch me and say, Is it you again? All human eyes are beautiful, but Pegeen's were very black and heavily lashed and gorgeous now, with the sparkle of her joke or her plan, or perhaps her vision of some impossible future. She straightened up. We'll see what happens then, she said, sly and confident, her thick eyebrows raised. She swung her purse slowly, turned to move on. That will be something to see, she said. At her own house, Pegeen didn't use the basement door as usual. She climbed the stone steps, taking them one at a time like a small child. At the top, she paused again to swat at the back of her coat, only touching the dirt with her wrist. It was early evening, spring. I could see Pegeen's reflection in the oval glass of the outer door, or at least the blue heart of the reflection, which was both the reflection of her good spring coat and the evening light on her flushed face.
That was Someone by Alice McDermott. Orphan Train is a gripping story of friendship and second chances from Christina Baker Klein. Penobscot Indian Molly Ayer is close to aging out of the foster care system. A community service position helping an elderly woman is the only thing keeping Molly out of juvie, or worse. As she helps Vivian sort through her possessions and memories, Molly learns she and Vivian aren't as different as they seem to be. A young Irish immigrant orphaned in New York City, Vivian was put on a train to the Midwest with hundreds of other children whose destinies would be determined by luck and chance. Molly discovers she has the power to help Vivian find answers to mysteries that have haunted her, answers that may ultimately free them both. Jessica Almasi and Suzanne Torin narrate.
Through her bedroom wall, Molly can hear her foster parents talking about her in the living room, just beyond her door. This is not what we signed up for, Dina is saying. If I'd known she had this many problems, I never would have agreed to it.
I know.
Ralph's voice is weary. He's the one, Molly knows, who wanted to be a foster parent. Long ago, in his youth, when he'd been a troubled teen, as he told her without elaboration, a social worker at his school had signed him up for the Big Brother program, and he'd always felt that his big brother, his mentor, he calls him, kept him on track. But Dina was suspicious of Molly from the start. It didn't help that before Molly, they'd had a boy who tried to set the elementary school on fire. I have enough stress at work, Dina says, her voice rising. I don't need to come home to this. Dina works as a dispatcher at the Spruce Harbor Police Station, and as far as Molly can see, there isn't much to stress over. A few drunk drivers, the occasional black eye, petty thefts, accidents. If you're going to be a dispatcher anywhere in the world, Spruce Harbor is probably the least stressful place imaginable. But Dina is high-strung by nature. The smallest things get to her. It's as if she assumes everything will go right, and when it doesn't, which, of course, is pretty often, she is surprised and affronted. Molly is the opposite. So many things have gone wrong for her in her 17 years that she's come to expect it. When something does go right, she hardly knows what to think. Which was just what had happened with Jack. When Molly transferred to Mount Desert High School last year, in 10th grade, most of the kids seemed to go out of their way to avoid her. They had their friends, their cliques, and she didn't fit into any of them. It was true that she hadn't made it easy. She knows from experience that tough and weird is preferable to pathetic and vulnerable, and she wears her goth persona like armor. Jack was the only one who'd tried to break through. It was mid-October, in social studies class. When it came time to team up for a project, Molly was, as usual, the odd one out. Jack asked her to join him and his partner, Jody, who was clearly less than thrilled. For the entire 50-minute class, Molly was a cat with its back up. Why was he being so nice? What did he want from her? Was he one of those guys who got a kick out of messing with the weird girl? Whatever his motive, she wasn't about to give an inch. She stood back with her arms crossed, shoulders hunched, dark, stiff hair in her eyes. She shrugged and grunted when Jack asked her questions, though she followed along well enough and did her share of the work. That girl is freaking strange, Molly heard Jody mutter as they were leaving class after the bell rang. She creeps me out. When Molly turned and caught Jack's eye, he surprised her with a smile. I think she's kind of awesome, he said, holding Molly's gaze. For the first time since she'd come to this school, she couldn't help herself. She smiled back. Over the next few months, Molly got bits and pieces of Jack's story. His father was a Dominican migrant worker who met his mother picking blueberries in Cherryfield, got her pregnant, moved back to the DR to shack up with a local girl, and never looked back. His mother, who never married, works for a rich old lady in a shorefront mansion. By all rights, Jack should be on the social fringes too, but he isn't. He has some major things going for him. Flashy moves on the soccer field, a dazzling smile, great big cow eyes, and ridiculous lashes. And even though he refuses to take himself seriously, Molly can tell he's way smarter than he admits, probably even smarter than he knows.
We've just heard Orphan Train by Christina Baker Klein. Jojo Moya's The Girl You Left Behind begins in France, 1916. Artist Edouard Lefebvre must part from his young wife Sophie to fight at the front. Edouard's portrait of Sophie draws the eye of the new commandant. As the officer's dangerous obsession deepens, Sophie risks everything, her family, her reputation, and her life, to see her husband again. Nearly a century later, Sophie's portrait is given to Liv Halston by her young husband shortly before his sudden death. A chance encounter reveals the painting's true worth, and a battle begins over the painting's legitimate owner. Liv's belief in what is right is put to the ultimate test. Claire Corbett and Penny Rollins narrate.
My thoughts turned black. I closed my eyes. And then I opened them. Go downstairs, I said. Plead ignorance. Ask him what Aurelion has done wrong. Talk to him. Distract him. Just give me some time before they come into the house.
What are you going to do?
I gripped my sister's arm. Go. But tell them nothing, you understand? Deny everything. My sister hesitated, then ran towards the corridor, her nightgown billowing behind her. I'm not sure I had ever felt as alone as I did in those few seconds. Fear gripping my throat and the weight of my family's fate upon me. I ran into Father's study and scrabbled in the drawers of the great desk, hurling its contents. Old pens, scraps of paper, pieces from broken clocks and ancient bills, onto the floor. Thanking God when I finally found what I was searching for. Then, I ran downstairs, opened the cellar door, and skipped down the cold stone stairs. So sure-footed now in the dark that I barely needed the fluttering glow of the candle. I lifted the heavy latch to the back cellar, which had once been stacked to the roof with beer kegs and good wine, slid one of the empty barrels aside, and opened the door of the old cast-iron bread oven. The piglet, still only half-grown, blinked sleepily. It lifted itself to its feet, peered out at me from its bed of straw, and grunted. Surely I have told you about the pig. We liberated it during the requisition of Monsieur Gerard's farm. Like a gift from God, it had strayed in the chaos, meandering away from the piglets being loaded into the back of a German truck, and was swiftly swallowed by the thick skirts of Grandma Poilin. We've been fattening it on acorns and scraps for weeks, in the hope of raising it to a size great enough for us all to have some meat. The thought of that crisp skin, that moist pork, has kept the inhabitants of Le Coq Rouge going for the past month. Outside, I heard my brother yelp again, then my sister's voice, rapid and urgent, cut short by the harsh tones of a German officer. The pig looked at me with intelligent, understanding eyes, as if it already knew its fate. "I'm so sorry, mon petit," I whispered. "But this really is the only way." And I brought down my hand. I was outside in a matter of moments. I had woken Mimi, telling her only that she must come, but to stay silent. The child has seen so much these last months that she obeys without question. She glanced up at me, holding her baby brother, slid out of bed, and placed a hand in mine. The air was sharp with the approach of winter, the smell of wood smoke lingering in the air from a brief fire earlier in the evening. I saw the commandant through the stone archway of the back door and hesitated. It was not Herr Becker, whom we knew and despised. This was a slimmer man, clean-shaven, impassive, watchful. Even in the dark, I thought I could detect intelligence rather than brutish ignorance in his manner, which made me afraid. This new commandant was gazing speculatively up at our windows, perhaps considering whether this building might provide a more suitable billet than the Fourier farm, where senior German officers slept. I suspect he knew that our elevated aspect would give him a vantage point across the town. There were stables for horses and 10 bedrooms, from the days when our home was the town's thriving hotel.
That was The Girl You Left Behind by Jojo Moyes. Beth Hoffman's best-selling debut, Saving CeCe Honeycutt, won admirers with its heartwarming story and cast of unforgettable characters. Now Beth returns with Looking for Me. Teddy Overman found her life's passion for furniture in a broken-down chair left on the side of the road in rural Kentucky. She learns to turn other people's cast-offs into beautifully restored antiques and eventually finds a way to open her own shop in Charleston. There, Teddy builds a life for herself, as unexpected and quirky as the customers who visit her shop. Though Teddy is surrounded by remarkable friends and finds love in the most surprising way, nothing can alleviate the haunting uncertainty she's felt in the years since her brother Josh's mysterious disappearance. When signs emerge that Josh might still be alive, Teddy is drawn to Kentucky on a journey that will change her life. Jenna Lamia narrates.
"You know what, Teddy? He reminds me of that little black and white dog in those cartoons. What was his name? Do you know who I'm talking about? Snoopy? Yes, that's it. He looks like Snoopy."
"I think so, too. When he wakes up in the morning and realizes that being loved isn't just a dream, he grins. I swear he does."
"Where was it you found him?"
"Limping down the side of the road. It was during that awful rainstorm back in March. I wrote you a note about it, remember?"
"Maybe he got lost. Did you try to find his owner?"
I pulled a dish towel from the basket and smoothed it over my knees. "No, he wasn't lost. He was running away from home. A bad home."
"Now, how in the world do you know that?"
I looked at Eddie and winked. "He told me."
"The dog told you?"
Mama shook her head, and we fell into a comfortable silence. I didn't know why, but everything about this visit seemed different. I had the feeling, or maybe it was just a hope, that in our uniquely inept ways we were trying to build a bridge toward each other, A fragile bridge, but a bridge just the same. While folding an apron, I glanced toward the barn. Soaring above the silo was a red-tailed hawk. Round and round he went, the pale underside of his belly catching the light, his wings outstretched as he floated in the sky. I couldn't see a hawk without thinking about my brother Josh. When we were kids living here on the farm, raptors were frequent visitors. Hawks, peregrine falcons, and even an occasional eagle. Early in the morning, Josh and I would often watch on the back porch as they soared out from their homes in the woods that stood behind the barn. The birds spent their days gliding low over the fields as they hunted for unsuspecting rabbits and squirrels. Sometimes they'd ride an air thermal and just glide and glide. After supper, when the sun hung low and shadows stretched long across the grass, the raptors would return home to the mysteries that lay hidden within the pillars of the giant trees. All the raptors were beautiful, yet it was the red-tailed hawks that left my brother spellbound. There were times when Josh would run through the hayfield with his eyes set on a hawk soaring in the sky, and he'd end up tripping in a tractor rut and falling flat on his face. And once, when he was racing alongside the barn, trying to keep a red tail in view, he ran smack into a fence and got a bloody nose. One summer's evening, when he was no more than six, Josh trotted across the lawn, overalls rolled up to his knees, his bare feet caked in dirt.
"Look, Teddy,"
he gasped, pointing toward the barn.
"See up there? That's the big guy, the one I told you about yesterday. I know that's him."
I got up from the porch swing and joined him on the back steps. And sure enough, perched on the tip of the silo was a red-tailed hawk. My brother looked at me.
"What do you think he's doing up there?"
I draped my arm around his shoulders. "I read a story about that hawk's great-great-granddaddy. He guarded an Indian who lived in a cave high above Red River Gorge. The hawk watched over him from the time he was just a little boy. They were best friends for all their lives. When the Indian grew old and died, do you know what happened?"
"What?"
"The hawk swooped down, spread his talons as wide as they'd go, and lifted the Indian's spirit right out of his body. And then he flew up through the clouds, past the moon and the stars, and straight into heaven. They're still together." My little brother drew in a breath.
"They are?"
I nodded. "And now this hawk is watching over you. He was born way up in Clifty Wilderness. And from all the other red tails in Kentucky, he was chosen to fly down here and be your guardian."
We've just heard Looking for Me by Beth Hoffman. Readers, I hope you've enjoyed journeying with me through these remarkable stories, chock full of those frequent and unavoidable bumps in the road. I find these tales really resonate, don't you? Thanks so much for joining me today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.